Okay, sorry about the slightly start. Should you be interested, what had happened is that somebody had turned off the whole AV system, and I came and plugged my laptop into it as it was booting up again, and it caused my laptop to crash. The mysteries of audio video. Anyway, everything's rebooted and happy. It's really empty today. Where is everybody? I know it's Friday, but this is kind of ridiculous. There's like 50 people in here. It's that. 51. But you don't have hand-ins on Fridays anymore, right? So you don't even have that, the excuse that you're kind of hammering away at Haskell or something. Oh, well. I worked. There's so many slides in this lecture. You can just tell them what they missed. So on Tuesday, I started talking about using Gaussians for classification and looking at the kind of more typical case when we've got real value data. So, today, what I want to do is to look at it's not a real example, but it's real data of using Gaussians to classify spoken vowels, and then we'll try and get through, because I think it's good to look at this example. We'll then try and get to look through the idea of decision regions and the idea of discriminant functions. So this is kind of changing our focus. So we were thinking in terms of generative models. How do you get a generative model for each class, a distribution for each class? And we want to change. We're going to start to change our focus to how do you learn functions which tell you how to classify a new piece of data? And as you'll see, there's a sort of close relation between the two, but they're also different. Anyway, so first I wanted to go through this example It actually took me a while to think of a good example, because I wanted an example that you could show the data in two dimensions, because it's much less I think clear as sort of presentationally, unless you know the data very well, to think of kind of multidimensional data and how the Gaussians might work. And in two dimensions, you can do contour plots of the Gaussians and so on, and get an idea of what's going on. So the example I came up with is actually something that I've worked on way, way back when, actually. It isn't real. Don't for a moment think of this as real speech recognition. What it is it's looking at a way to classify different vowel sounds. So vowel sounds are things like ah and e and eh and so on. And it's basically just looking at the sort of the steady part of the centre of a vowel. So if you say a word like dog, then the sort of oh sound is sort of steady in the centre of the vowel oh, but before it, well, your tongue and the way your vocal tract is configured are actually moving from the d sound, and at the end of it, they're going to the g sound. So we're looking at the central parts of vowels. Now, it turns out, and if you're interested, then I couldn't imagine a better use of time than to find out more about this. It turns out, so the way speech works is you've got a vocal tract, so you sort of have the lungs, which are this kind of power source, and you kind of have the vocal cords, which is the fundamental frequency, the pitch of your voice. But the thing that actually controls the sounds you make is the way you configure your vocal tract. And in particular for vowels, you can characterize the vowels by what are called the formant frequencies, which are the resonances of your vocal tract. So what you're doing when you speak, you're like moving your tongue and your lips, and in so doing, you're changing the resonant frequencies of that vocal tract. So by kind of pushing the tongue up to the back of your mouth, then you're kind of shortening the effective length of the vocal tract. But in other things, you might be having the tongue at the tip of, the tongue tip going out to the front of your mouth, maybe the lips around it, and that will also have an effect on the frequencies of the vocal tract. Now, don't worry too much about this, but there is usually three or four identifiable formants, or these resonant frequencies. And we typically call them F1, F2, F3, so on. The basic pitch of your voice is known as F0. And the first two formants are F1 and F2. And you can actually characterize vowels quite well by the first two formants. If some of you will know all this because you've done Linguistics 1, or even better, Linguistics 2B. Maybe you're doing Linguistics 2B. And you can draw the relation between the sounds of the vowels in what shape, like a two-dimensional quadrilateral. Anyway, back in about 1951, two phoneticians named Peterson and Barney recorded a bunch of spoken vowels by American men, women, and children. And they were concerned with 10 spoken vowels, and they made two recordings of each vowel per person. And what I've done for these examples is I've removed all the children's speech, because that's a little bit different, because the vocal tract is much shorter for children and so on, and just kept it as a male and female speech. And I did a split of the data into training and test sets, such that all the data from a speaker is either in the training set or in the test set. So you know that the training set doesn't overlap in terms of speakers with the test set. And what's interesting is let's classify the data. Is it interesting? It is for this course. Let's classify the data using a Gaussian classifier. And we may come back to this and classify it using some other things later on. And to make things easy, we'll assume equal priors. Now, this, in a way, the data setup, that's not too bad a thing, because it was basically telling people to sit down and sort of say, you know, say heart now, heart. And there was an equal distribution over all the vowels. Of course, in real language, there are some words that occur more often than other words, and hence some vowels occur more often than other vowels. But we won't take this into account. So these are the vowels. Again, if you want, you can just think of them as classes 1 to 10. But it's kind of more meaningful if you kind of, course it's more meaningful if you consider what vowels they correspond to. So we have these 10 vowels. We have the vowel E. Again, this is these symbols. It's actually something called the. So again, if you've done linguistics or something sensible like that, you might well know the International Phonetic Alphabet, which is a kind of standardized system for writing the sounds of language, but writing them in a written form. But back in the 1980s, before people had the wonders of Unicode and so on, it was of great interest to go and get a coding system which you could write in ASCII. So this thing is called the Alphabet, because it was developed under a bunch of projects sponsored by an agency called ARPA. So these are just kind of two-letter annotations for each of these sounds. So we've got E, which is like the vowel in B, and we have I, which is like the vowel in big, and we have E, which is like the vowel in red, and we have A, which is like the vowel in at. And then this thing, is a kind of schwa. It's called schwa. It's a sort of vowel we use a lot, and it's used more and more in certain accents, which is sort of fairly to the center of the vowel space. So the way most people say honey, perhaps not me, actually. I have a bit of an when I say honey. If you're an American, the way I say honey, I can't do that. It's that sort of vowel. The way most people say the as well is that sort of vowel. Then we have heart. The R in heart, and the A in frost, and the U in could, and the U in you, and the in bird. So those are the classes we're looking at. So what we're going to get is we're going to get this formant data, which is frequencies that you can get from the vocal tract. How you get those? How you get that data is quite interesting. So you can get what's called a spectrogram of speech, which is basically it's basically just analysing the frequencies in the speech signal, sort of 10 milliseconds by 10 milliseconds. And for these steady-state vowels, it's relatively straightforward to extract the formants. For normal sort of conversational speech, like I'm saying now, it's actually a much harder thing. So again, this is something which might delude you into thinking speech recognition is easier than it turns out to be. Anyway, this is an extremely busy graph, but it's the training data from the 10 classes. And I think, if I remember correctly, there's like 102 points per class, so there's 1,020 points here. Note that cyan, blue, and red are each used for two different classes. So this is the train data for the class. So you have the I sounds are up here, and the E sounds, which are quite close to I, in the way you say them, are sort of next to them, and then you get the E sounds there, and the ah sounds is quite a broad area there. So what you've got in this, this is representing each point in terms of its two feature vector, in terms of its two features. We've got a two-dimensional feature vector. So along here, you have the frequency of F1, the first formant, and that goes from about, well, indeed, for some it goes down as low as 200. It's normally about 300 hertz up to about 1,000 is the range for F1. And then F2 is normally a few hundred hertz up to about 2,000 or 3,000. So you can see that the scales aren't the same. This goes from 0 to 1,200, and this goes from 500 to 3,500. But that's just to avoid lots of white on the graph. So these are all our feature vectors. And what we want to do is to learn a classifier so that when we get new vowels, also expressed as these F1, F2 vectors, hopefully we can classify them. So using a Gaussian classifier, we can then estimate a Gaussian class model for each class. So I just did this in the data in MATLAB, and for each class, for the training data, I estimate the mean and the covariance to get you to estimate the Gaussian for each class. So that's the Gaussian for class 1, that's the Gaussian for class 2, that's the Gaussian for class 3. You can see there's really quite substantial overlap between the classes. It's the Gaussian for class 4, and for class 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. So those are our 10 Gaussians which represent each class. So we can, if you want to declutter the graph and get rid of the training data, this is basically our set of Gaussians for each class, and it's essentially now these are our class models, and it's what we're going to use to classify test data. So we have a bunch of test data, and to make it clear what's going on, I mean normally you wouldn't know what classes the test data came from, but here to make it clear what's going on, I'm presenting the test data class by class, so you can see how well each class is recognized. So we have some test data for class 1, which is the vowel E, and that's actually pretty good. Actually, what I found, and this was purely by chance, is that it turned out that most of the test data was in fact more tightly clustered than the training data, and we'll see that later on actually. So these are some test points from different speakers speaking the same vowels, male and female, the vowel E. One might hypothesize that those are male speakers and those are female speakers, but I really don't know, just looking at the change in formant. And we see that in this case, for each of those points, so the way we classify it, right, for each point, you go and see the probability of that point being generated by one of the Gaussians. So for each point, you compute 10 Gaussians, whichever one is biggest, that's the class that point goes into. So we do that for each of those 20 points, and we see, hurrah, it does really well. All of these 20 test points are classified correctly in the Gaussian for class E. And then we look for data from the second class, the class E. So this is data here. This class has quite a big overlap, right, with class 3. But again, it turns out, luckily, that we classify all 20 of those points correctly. So each of those points, and well, of course you can see it because it's correct, has a higher probability of being generated by the dark blue Gaussian than the cyan Gaussian or the red Gaussian or whatever. So we're doing pretty well. After the first two classes, we've got 100% correct on our test set. Next, we go and look at data for the third class, E, as you'd hear in red, and that's kind of quite a bit more distributed. I think it's kind of the data is sort of around here, it turns out. So there's certainly sort of some overlap, and these two are sort of quite out, you know, are outlying quite a lot. They're not really very probable from any Gaussian. And we see what happens there. And in this case, we get some confusion. So we get 15 of the 20 are classified correctly, but four are classified as the black class Ur, and one is classified as the class A. So you can see the four that are going to be classified as Ur. Maybe you can't, but it's going to be, I think, those four there. I can see it, but maybe if you're right at the back, you should be looking at the slides on the web or something. So here, we're just building up the confusion matrix, right? So the confusion matrix, each column corresponds to the true class, and each row corresponds to the predicted class. So for each of the first two classes, each true class test point was correctly predicted. And then for the third one, 15 of them were correctly predicted, but four were predicted to the wrong class, and one was predicted to another wrong class. We can carry on. We can look at the next class. Again, there's a little bit of overlap. So that guy there is going to be classified as air instead of air, and so on. And we see the 16 classified correctly, three confused with the class air, and one confused with the class air. So I guess that confusion is going to be sort of that guy and maybe these three there or something. It's some those two that will get classified as cyan because they're well out of the pink zone. So we're building up our confusion matrix, and we can just carry on with the test data. So we have data for class 5, and we find that there's 18 classified correctly. We have data for class 6, the blue things here, 17 of those classified correctly. A couple, for example, like this one, are classified in a different class, class 5. We carry on, we look at class 7, which are these cyan guys down here. There's a bit of overlap with these things here, so we find 16 are classified correctly, 4 are classified in another class. And we can carry on like this. The red class 8, again, if the leading diagonal of this confusion matrix are the things you've classified correctly, all the off-diagonal ones are the misclassifications. We can look at class 9, the U sound like you get in U, which is down here. We find 15 were classified correctly, but there's sort of 5 which are really, you know, which are just in the overlap with the red. And then finally, we've got class 10, which is the Ur class. And again, we have 18 classified correctly. So if we kind of go down the column, we can see that we get 100% of the first two classes right, then 75% of the next class, and 85% of class R, and so on. And we find in total we get 86.5% correct. So this is after training on about 1,000, and I think it's 1,020 data points, and then testing on these 200 data points, and we get about 86.5% correct. This isn't bad, in my view. This is actually pretty good because you've got these heavily overlapping classes. It's hard to see that with this data, if you can get any simple classifier, which is going to do much better. If you're interested, when people are played this data, and of course when they're played it, they're not just played F1, F2, they just hear the whole sound. They agree on about something like 98% of the classifications. So that's basically just showing the example of how we're using a Gaussian classifier for a classification problem. So what have we done? We've got our data. Training and test sets, both in this case, two-dimensional feature vectors. We train a Gaussian for each class, just estimating the mean and the variance for each class from the data in that class. And then that's our model. We have a Gaussian model for each class. And then when we get some test data, we just classify each test data point using the Gaussian that has the highest probability. Of course, in this case, we were assuming equal priors. If you want to look how well these Gaussians would classify the training set, because it's always interesting to do that. And because there's quite a lot of data in the training set, and because the Gaussians are sort of quite restricted, all you've got to estimate really is the two-dimensional mean and the covariance matrix. There's actually quite a lot of overlap in the training set, and to some degree, it's actually rather more dispersed, I think, than the test set. And we find that there's no class which is 100% correct over the 1,020 pieces of 1,020 examples in the training set, and we find that we get about 80% correct, which is actually quite a lot lower than the test set. But I think that's just because it's because of the data. So what we can conclude there is that actually for this particular case, training Gaussians on this data actually generalizes pretty well. It certainly isn't performing worse on the test data than the training data, and that's a good thing. Maybe you'd like to get some more complicated model. Maybe you could learn a kind of better structure in the data rather than modeling everything basically using these ellipses, really. Maybe you could do better than that. But it's actually not working too badly, and, you know, 80 to 85% correct is, you know, it may not be too bad. It's always hard to know. If you guessed randomly, of course, you'd get 10% correct because there's 10 classes. So if you kind of want to know what the whole classification looks like, then like we did on the fake data last time, you can plot decision regions. So the way I've plotted these decision regions is that for every point in the two-dimensional space, we've marked what class that would be classified to. You can do this just by evaluating all the Gaussians, and you go and choose the biggest one. So you can see that you've got the red class here, and one of the blue classes here, and that black class in the middle there. And we have another class there. I think these two are the same class, actually. They just spread out to infinity that way. And the yellow one is the same class that gets blitted out by the blue one going on top of it. So what you can get is you can get kind of a map of the space, which is giving you the decision regions. So once you've computed all the Gaussians, then there's kind of no randomness when you come to do the classification. You've kind of mapped out the space, and you've mapped out decision regions in the space, and you can see, well, how does the classifier carve up the space? So it does, you know, we clearly know it doesn't do a bad job. Although, of course, where there's sort of no data, it just kind of goes off to infinity like that, and you've got no reason to believe that's a really good decision boundary. But it may well be that the sort of decision boundary around the black class is actually pretty good because there's a lot of data constraining that. So what I'd now like to... So at this point, are there any questions about this, or is this all... Well, let me put it another way. Would you now feel happy and confident to go off and do this classification for some new data? Well, I can see a lot of poker faces out there. So maybe yes, maybe no. You know, this is the drawback of lectures, right? You can kind of sit there and go, yeah, it's easy. Type mail, check some text, easy, yes. Still that easy, but actually it's kind of hard. You shouldn't really be too passive, but I used to do lab classes, but they weren't assessed and nobody did them because you all have loads of coursework elsewhere, so I can give you data if you want to do it, but maybe I will, nobody will, and anyway, sorry, I shouldn't pass my depression on to you. Yes.
This will be used in practice for guessing words, right?
So yeah, you hope better than guessing, but yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Do you need to say for each about, for example, which particular entities, or isn't it better to assign probabilities so when they get some word that's actually not?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So you're absolutely right. If you want to combine this to do word recognition, absolutely. But you may well want to, at some point, you'll want to do a classification. And this is just a simple case where we're just doing vowel classification. One of the first commercial speech recognizers, which wasn't really thought of as a speech recognizer, was sold in about 1921. And it was a thing called Radio Rex. And Radio Rex was a kind of little plastic dog kennel with a little dog in. If you said Rex, the dog would jump out and bark and then go back in. It had a little piece of analog circuitry in to do that. And what that circuitry was actually doing, it basically had a resonance at about 700 hertz, and it was doing F1 recognition on the vowel Rex. So if you said, you know, Rex, it would jump out. But if you said, I don't know, Rix, because you were from Australia or something, then it wouldn't jump out. And that was kind of cool for 1921. And these things still exist, and they go for a huge amount of money on eBay, as it turns out. That's another story. But yeah, your point's a really good one. Your point's a really, really good one, actually, because on the one hand, the way to do really good pattern recognition or whatever is to delay making decisions for as long as possible, and you want to kind of propagate probabilities forward as long as possible, and that's a really important principle. But on the other hand, at some point, you do want to make a decision, because you might, you know, a different thing. If it's a spam filter, you actually want to, at some point, you've got to make a decision. You can't just sit on the fence the entire time and say, well, I'm 80% sure of this, but I'd like some more data. At some point, no matter what you're doing, you've got to make a decision. So if the decision you have to make is, what's the phoneme? Did the person say Rex? Then if you use Gaussians, these are the decision regions you have if you've just got F1 and F2. Any other questions? Okay, we'll go on to talking about decision boundaries. So far, I've kind of been we've had this tacit assumption that classifying things according to the maximum posterior probability is a good thing to do, and I'd just like to. You shouldn't always just go forward on belief that something's a good thing to do. You should try to have some evidence for that. So let's look at this. So to keep things easy, we'll move back into one dimension. So we have a one-dimensional feature space. So we just have these feature numbers x, and we have two classes, C1 and C2. So we divide the space into decision regions. So here, our decision regions are kind of regions of a two-dimensional space. In this case, decision regions are just regions of a one-dimensional line, so it's a bit easier, but of course it generalizes. So, and basically, points in region R1 are assigned to class 1, and points in region R2 are assigned to class 2. So that's basically how we think of the pattern recognition problem. And, of course, what we'd actually like to do is to place a decision boundary so as to minimize the probability of misclassification. So to make it even simpler, we'll think we've got our real line, and we just put a mark on it somewhere. Everything to the left is class 1, everything to the right is class 2, and that's our decision boundary. So there's two types of errors you can make, right? You can assign x to class 1 when it truly belongs to class 2, or put it another way, x is in region 1 when it actually belongs to class 2. And the other type of error is x is in region 2 when it belongs to class 1, because when x is in region 2, it's assigned to class 2. So these are the two, I mean, this is really simple, but we'll go directly from this to a little equation which will elucidate things. So we can write down what we would like to do, or what I said we'd like to do, is that we'd like to place our decision boundary to minimize the probability of misclassification. So we'd better know what that actually is. If we want to minimize it, we'd better have an expression for it. So we can do this because we can say, well, what's the probability of error? Well, the probability, the total probability of error is the probability of making an error of this type, or the plus the probability of making an error of that type, because two types of errors, so you've got to add those probabilities. So it's the probability of X being placed in region 2 when it belongs to class 1, plus the probability of X being placed in region 1 when it belongs to class 2. Now, those are joint probabilities, so we can just rewrite them as a product of the marginal probability of C1 multiplied by the conditional, the probability of X in region 2 given C1, and likewise for the other side. So we've just turned this into a product of two things. And, well, this thing's okay, this is just our prior probability. What's this probability of X being in region 2 given C1? Well, we know how to do that because we're working in the world we're working in. We have probability density functions, so we have the probability density function for X given class 1 and the probability density function for X given class 2. That's how we do our classification. So the overall probability of X being in region 2 is we just take our density function and we integrate it over region 2. So this is, you know, this is exactly what you saw when we were dealing with one-dimensional things, looking at probability densities. And at the moment we're looking at one-dimensional things, but you can just generalize this. You can integrate over many dimensions, should you wish. Although of course it's easier to integrate in one dimension. So that's what we've got. We've now got the probability of error is the sum of these two integrals. First, integrating over region 2. And we're basically integrating the densities of X given class 1 multiplied by the prior of class 1. So we're multiplying the probability of class 1 generating a region generating an X that's in region 2 plus the probability of class 2 generating an X that's in region 1, because those are the two ways you can make mistakes. So if we look at it in terms of Gaussians, what those two regions are that we're summing is that the filled-in dark red and dark blue things are the two parts of that summation. If we assume we've got a decision boundary at zero here, then you've got these red guys here, which is the probability of classifying to the red class, although it's in the blue class, and the other way around, the probability of classifying if we've got a decision boundary here, sorry, this red stuff is the probability of something that is truly red being classified as blue. And here is the probability that something which is truly blue is classified as red, because this is where our decision boundary is. So we've got these two Gaussians, which we've trained on the data. And we could move the decision boundary. And if we move it, we might reduce the probability of misclassifying these guys, but at the cost of increasing the probability of misclassifying those guys. So for each decision boundary, we can compute what the probability of error is going to be. And you can probably already see that this is in fact going to be the minimum when you've got these Gaussians. If you go this way, then you've got a lot extra probability mass coming in. So this is the thing that we want to minimize. And the way we can think of minimizing this is we want to minimize these two integrals. So how do we do that? Well, to minimize these two integrals, it's, well, how do you classify each point X? So for each point X, you want to look at the joint probability of X in class 1 and the joint probability for X in class 2. And you want to, so if you put X in region 1, then the probability of misclassification, therefore, is the probability that it actually comes from class 2. Or the other way around, if you put X in region 2, the probability of misclassification is that it comes from, in fact, region 1. So if you want to minimize those probabilities of misclassification, you want to keep this sum to be the smallest for each point. So the way to do that, this seems a very long way round to get to something that I hope is quite intuitive, is that if the joint probability of X and C1 is greater than the joint probability of X and C2, then you classify point X into region 1. So therefore, the potential contribution to error is just the thing arising from the probability of x given c2, and we do that for every point. So this means that if that's our rule, then and we came on that rule not because we're thinking about probabilities, but because we're thinking about minimizing these integrals, then the way to minimize the probability of misclassification is to assign each point to the class which has the highest product of probability density times prior probability, which is proportional to the posterior probability. So this gives us some justification, or in this two-class one-dimensional case, or I think already it holds for n dimensions, in this two-class case, it gives us a justification for saying, well, we want to classify x into the class with the maximum posterior probability, because that's the thing that minimizes this probability of error. Because we always want to have the smallest possible probability of error. So that's how you justify taking this posterior probability classification rule if we're working with two classes. And it turns out that you can basically extend this justification if you're working with more than two classes. If you're working with k classes, you can still just got more terms in, right? But you can still minimize the posterior probability by always assigning each point to the class. Sorry, you can minimize the probability of error by assigning each point to the class with the maximum posterior probability. Any questions? It helps to draw it out and look at the regions on a piece of paper. So what you find is that this basically, again, if we assume equal priors, this corresponds to the rule for maximizing, for assigning a class to the one with the maximum posterior probability, because the decision boundary is where the two Gaussians cross, and you know, heading rightwards, it's where blue becomes lower than red. So you change from assigning to blue to assigning to red. So as we said, these guys are the showing the probabilities of error. And if you move that boundary anywhere, then the probability of error would increase. If you moved it to the right, it would increase like that. If you moved it to the left, it would be symmetric, and you'd get more errors of from colouring in the blue. So the best you can do is to have the decision boundary the decision boundary itself falls at the point the posterior probabilities are equal. Yeah.
Can you have examples where it is more important to get one of the classes right rather than the other? Then you have to move the decision boundary.
Yeah, that's. It's another good question. It's a different story, actually. So the answer is yes, but we're not going to talk about it. So in statistics, it's something called risk. So where's a really good example of this? You're a bank, and you're trying to determine fraud. So you've got to say, is a transaction fraudulent or not? And you may not, you can estimate your posterior probabilities, but you may not, you know, if it just says 0.6% chance of fraud. So the funny thing is that if it said, you might think, oh, a bank wants to be really careful, so you'd have to have a really, really high probability that it's a good transaction, otherwise we'll stop it. It's actually the other way around if you're a bank. If it's like a 0.6 probability of fraud, it's like, yeah, go ahead. But if it's some higher, then you want to stop it, because the cost of fraud is much less than the cost of upsetting customers who go away and take business away. Plus, I guess they don't really believe their own models. So that's exactly a situation where you can get as good an estimate as possible of the posterior probability, but you've got your own risk function that you apply to it, and you say, oh, but I want to be you know, really sure of this. Another good example is what's another example? Diagnosis of diseases, right? If you don't want to tell somebody they've got a terminal disease and they've got 3 months to live on a probability of 0.51, right? You would hope to be able to get some more evidence and sharpen up the distributions one way or the other. So there again, there's a kind of very high risk factor because you know, you've made your... So it's not a question of being able to adjust the priors or something like that, you may have made, based on the available data at this current time, you may have made the best possible decision, or you may have made the best possible estimate of your posterior probability, but you've still got some risk in what decisions you want to make, and you may say, no, no, it's got to be really probable, it's got to be really sharp before I go and make this decision. So that's a really good point. And if you go to a statistics book and look at risk, then you'll have lots of things there. But yeah, it's a really good point. Any other questions? Okay, let's talk about discriminant functions. Don't worry, by the way, there's always at least one lecture slack in this course, so we're never going to run out, well, I won't say never going to run out of time, but it doesn't matter if we get behind time a bit. So, discriminant functions. So, discriminant functions are where you start taking a slightly different view on the world. And we've sort of been moving here. So, we started off thinking of generative models. We're now thinking in terms of classification. You can think of a discriminant function as a classification function. So, basically, you want a function, you give it x, and it tells you what classification to make. So, if you have multiple classes, then you have to have multiple functions, one for each class. And you call it yc of x for class c, and you evaluate that for each class. The one that's biggest, that's the way you classify it. If you have two classes, you can have a single function, right? Because one can be y and the other one can be 1 minus y, so that's fine as well. But most generally, you want a function for each class which tells you which kind of gives you, if you like, the classification probability for that class. But you don't have to think in terms of probabilities here. These are just functions which give you numbers, and you choose the biggest. So, but you still want to know, well, what sort of functions could we have for these magic discriminant functions? So we've just gone through a long exercise justifying one such function, which is the posterior probability. That's a good function. You can write the posterior probability for each class. So if you identify yc of x with the posterior probability of c given x, and you've got a functional form for the posterior probability of c given x, which you do if you're using a Gaussian to model a class, then that's your discriminant function. Now, log is a monotonic function. So you don't have to work with posterior probabilities. You might want to work with log posterior probabilities. And that's a kind of useful thing to work with. You've seen that already, because if you're dealing with Gaussians, the log annihilates the exponential, and it becomes a bit simpler to work with. So you could work with log posterior probability function as your discriminant function. So if you were using a Gaussian to model each class, then your discriminant function for class C, you could write as being log of the probability density of x given c, plus log of the prior probability of C. You don't have to bother, as I've said before, with the denominator P of X, the kind of a term which would be minus log P of X, because that's the same for every function. It doesn't depend on C. You're only concerned with the things that depend on C. So those are our discriminant functions. You've got a decision boundary between two classes K and L. Well, that's just when the discriminant functions are equal, when yk of x equals yl of x. So if you look in something like, this is the boundary when y1 of x equals y2 of x, and this is when y2 of x equals y3 of x, and this is when y10 of x equals y3 of x, and so on. So we've changed the emphasis. We've changed the emphasis not from having a machine to generate examples of each class. So we're not thinking of an E machine and an I machine and an E machine anymore. What we're now thinking of, if you want to think of it in terms of a machine, but we're now thinking of something which describes the boundaries between E and I and I and E. So you've got these discriminant functions which are functions which are telling you about the boundaries between classes. And it turns out that that's an interesting way to kind of view the world. So what is a discriminant? How are we going to go with this? We'll just do this very quickly. What does the discriminant function look like for Gaussian PDF? So we said we're looking at the log of the posterior probability. So it's got two parts. You're looking at the log of the probability density function, the Gaussian of x given the class, plus the log of the prior. So we put in the form of a Gaussian, and we can drop the constant terms, like the 2 pi to the d over 2 type of term. And we get, or d over 2 log 2 pi, or whatever, we get these terms here. So this is basically the argument to the Gaussian, x minus the mean transpose times the inverse of the covariance matrix times x minus the mean. Remember, this is the vector equation. And remember the shape of it. It looks like this. And it's a number. Plus this minus half of the log of the covariance matrix for the class. That's the bit that's in the normalizing term for the Gaussian. The determinant of the covariance matrix, plus the log of the prior. So the important thing to notice is that this function is quadratic in x. So if you multiplied all these things out, you kind of like get a kind of x sigma to the minus 1 x term, or xt sigma to the minus 1 x term, and then you get a kind of x sigma to the minus 1 mu, and a mu sigma to the minus 1 x, and a mu sigma to the minus 1 mu term, and then these things here. So you've got that term which is quadratic in x, then you have some terms linear in x, then you have some constant terms. So it's a quadratic equation in x. So it's actually quite a nice, simple function to deal with. The world of quadratic equations is okay, right? We've been happy with those since we were, I don't know, 3 or something. But let's stop, because it's 5 o'clock and it's Friday. But we shall return to this.